Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Hispanics are the fastest growing ethnic group in the U.S. By 2050, an estimated 30% of the population will be Hispanic, almost double what it is now. But locally, the numbers are quite a bit smaller, around 3% in Kentucky and 6% in Indiana. In Vandenberg County, the numbers are just over 2%. Joining me now to talk about Hispanic Heritage Month and a brand new Latino arts outreach program in Evansville is Arcea Zapata de Aston. She is the founder and president of EDUCA, which stands for Education and Cultural Advancement for Latinos. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also in the studio, visiting artist Jorge Mendoza, who grew up in Bolivia but has lived in the U.S. since the late 80s. Bienvenido.
Thanks for having us here.
And Arcea, Hispanic Heritage Month started on September 15th. It runs through October 15th. Why does it start in the middle of the month?
Well, actually, one of the reasons or the starting point for the Hispanic Heritage Month in September is because it coincides with the anniversary of the independence of five Latin American countries. And also there are other countries in South America and Central America like Chile, Belize, and Mexico that have their independence during those times.
So a big month for Latin American
countries.
For
Latin American, definitely.
And that reminds us, when you talk about all these different Latin American countries, that Hispanics and Latinos come from many different places. When we talk about Hispanics or Hispanic Heritage Month, do we run the risk of lumping them all together and making it into one culture?
Well, actually, this is interesting because I teach a class that is Latinos in the United States, and my students always ask me questions, as well as people in the community, why some people call them Hispanics and others call them Latinos. And after explaining to them, we get to the conclusion that actually it's the same. There is no difference. The important thing that I tell my students to learn is that Hispanics come from España, the language, the culture, and Latinos, Latin America. So the term Latino, for some people, it could be more inclusive because it includes Brazil also. They don't speak Spanish, they speak Portuguese, but they're part of Latin America. And really, when we talk about Hispanics or Latinos, we have to think about diversity in within diversity. We are a very diverse group.
Exactly, because you have many countries in Central America, in South America. You could even lump Spain in. Of course, Hispanics would include people who are from Spain itself.
People from Spain, they would not even think about...
No, they would consider themselves Spanish. Yeah, they're Europeans. What do you think are the most common public misconceptions about Hispanics or Latinos?
Well, I think, unfortunately, lately, when people think about Hispanics or Latinos, they think about the people that have just gotten here recently. And there are a lot of stigmas and stereotypes that are kind of part of this group. And the misconception is they are not educated. They don't have an idea of what being an immigrant is about. They don't understand that. They want to live here, but they want to continue being what they are in the country, speak the language, continue the culture. And I think it's a tremendous misconception because Latinos have been here since 1565. If you go back,
St. Augustine, Florida.
Yes, and then definitely I tell my students all the time, and people, you think about Ponce de León was the first one that stepped there in Florida, and the name, he gave the name to Florida.
And this is the oldest ethnic group in North America after the Native Americans.
Oh, definitely. Yes. Yeah. And the history is wonderful, beautiful, and rich. And if people were to think a second about what Latinos is and their history, believe me, they would change in a second the idea that they have about Latinos and Hispanics
and
in the
United
States.
And it's just flukes of world history that means that we predominantly speak English here as opposed to speaking Spanish.
Yes. And you know, if you go to the West Coast and you see and understand what happened with the Chicanos, and even if you go to the East Coast and the Puerto Ricans and then Florida, the Cubans, then probably the understanding of what the history of Latinos and Hispanics is about would be more clear and better.
Mm-hmm. Jorge Mendoza, you grew up in La Paz, Bolivia. You lived there for about 25 years.
That's right.
You've also lived in Puerto Rico, in Mexico, in Spain, in Brazil, In Miami, which is nice because it's so close to the U.S.
Yeah, right. Looks like USA there.
Yeah, yeah. What's your experience been of living in these different countries? How different are the cultures between these countries?
Well, let me tell you that it could be assembled like a big neighborhood. Each house is different than the other, with the particularities and similarities and also some different things. But we all have a main root, that is the language, and we have more or less the same traditions, you know, and more or less we share the same maybe skin tone, some particularities that are really interesting on everybody, you know. But yeah, there are some differences between, for instance, Mexico and Puerto Rico and Spain. And basically, if we consider Spain as the somehow some part of the root of South America, on Central and Latin America, and yeah, definitely. But we share too many common grounds.
Although, as Arcea Zapata de Aston pointed out, Brazil, which is the largest country in South America, does not speak Spanish.
That's right.
Portuguese.
Yes, they speak Portuguese. And actually, I'm married with a Brazilian lady, and I have two beautiful kids that they grew up here. They came at 2 and 3 years. So basically, we consider these guys are like North American educated. Yeah, but that's the language. Probably it's not a really a separation between waters in South America, because the frontiers of Brazil are very integrated with the other countries. And also we share some nice rhythm and music, you know, that we love. Me as a Bolivian, I love Brazilian first with the music and second with the sport, you know.
Sure.
And then that's that kind of, and the culture also, you know, that is.
And as we observed at the beginning of this segment, Latinos are the fastest growing segment of the U.S. population, if you look at the whole U.S. But if you look at this region here in Indiana and in Kentucky, it's a very small portion of the population. Would you say this is a hidden population here, Arcea Zapata de Aston?
Well, I think that it's changing. I think it's going to be more and more the case when we see in these small cities, people will come more and more just because they're finding out that it's getting very difficult in the big cities. I think that hidden, I would think it could be in a figurative way, a way for these people to feel more secure and safe because of all the big, new laws that are taking place in the big cities. Mm-hmm. They feel so scared that they're trying to get to places where they feel that they're not going to be somehow harassed in a way. Or
You're talking about laws that target illegal immigrants,
yes,
specifically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would think so. And as far as people that's probably that have been here, like in my case, I came here because I had a job here. And I'm in the academia, and you know, you go where the job is. So you find out that after a while, it's the place where you want to be. It's safe, it's nice, it's small, and you can raise your kids in a very safe environment.
And your job, we should mention, is teaching at Kentucky Wesleyan College in,
yes,
Owensboro.
I'm a professor in the Modern,
exactly,
Languages Department.
Right. So you teach Spanish, yeah.
Yes.
How would you characterize the Latinos who are living in this region? Where are they from?
I tell you, we have small, I call them colonies. So we have a very, very small colony of Colombian and probably some people from Venezuela. But I think in general, Mexicans and some Central Americans are going to be probably the biggest group that we will have in within the Latinos.
Mm-hmm. And there are, you see that the growth that is happening more broadly around the U.S., you think that growth is also slowly going to be happening here as well?
I think so. Definitely, mm-hmm, it's going that way.
We're talking Hispanic Heritage Month on The Trend on WNIN. We're talking with Arcea Zapata de Aston. She's the founder and president of Educa, which we'll talk about in a minute, and also talking with visiting artist Jorge Mendoza. More after a break. This is The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. Support for the program today comes through a grant from the Charles and Jan Stimson-Ogle family, who encourage your support of public broadcasting. And from Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life for more than 60 years. Information online at evansvilledayschool.org.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Still ahead, Tech Talk and Angel Mound's Native American Days. But right now we're talking Hispanic Heritage Month with Arcea Zapata de Aston and Jorge Mendoza. And Arcea, you're the founder and president of a group called EDUCA, which stands for Educational and Cultural Advancement for Latinos. That's a group based in Evansville and in Owensboro. And what's your mission?
Oh, it's a big mission. I really, I've been always very keen on education and helping people that really need to get to the next step. I started EDUCA a while ago, and I want really the Latinos to integrate and to get an education that will allow them to get to the next level. And next level means to get be part of the mainstream of the society here in the United States, and also feel comfortable in not having language barriers.
So you teach language courses and offer career training and so forth? Connect with career training.
Yes, we do work with in partnership with the Mexican consulate, so we have the Plaza Comunitaria. So we offer elementary, secondary education, literacy education for them, and that they will get the diploma and certificate just like if they were in Mexico. We do the ESL. The ESL, of course, is English as a second language. The idea is to get them involved in the community, be able to understand and communicate with people in their jobs, with their kids, teachers, and also be able to understand what the culture is about.
Now, you're launching a new initiative this week, and that's called EduLartes. And tell me about what that is.
Actually, EduLarte is an initiative that is based mainly on giving the Latinos a space, and that space is being able to get into the arts. Initiative is mainly supported by the Owensboro Symphony. They invited me to be part of the board of directors of the symphony, so I could outreach the Latino population, and I thought this is a wonderful opportunity for me to get these kids that have never had an opportunity to get to a theater, play an instrument, or doing something like that. So I am doing that not just in music, but in any other arts and even culinary arts and everything like that.
So a chance for people who are Latino to be in an environment where they can be fostered in their own artistic expression as well as be exposed to other...
Yes, definitely. And we just started that initiative this past Wednesday when we had a great program with the kids of Cape Head Start at St. John's Head Start program, where we had close to 40 kids, and the artist Jorge Mendoza was able to to work with them. And believe me, that was the most rewarding experience I've ever seen. These kids were so happy to see an artist working with them, teaching them how to paint the colors, explaining to them. It was just great. So I'm so happy for that.
And Jorge, some of your work is specifically work that draws on your own heritage, your own Bolivian heritage, some of it less so. But what do you see as the role of art in expressing who you are and your cultural heritage?
Okay. The question is broad because I guess I, as a painter or as a person, I've been educated according to Eurocentrism, you know, the people that came from Spain, from Europe, show us how to work with, for instance, colors and canvas, and we are accustomed to that kind of, you know, Renaissance idea of colors, depth, and this kind of representation of image. Generally, it was religion, you know, because that was the way that drove people to the religion, in this case, the Christianism. that happened in Europe also, with the churches, outside buildings, and the sculptures. But I saw a depth interpretation of myself, so I see different people. I don't want to be reflected in the Eurocentrism way of representation, using their colors, using their images, the iconography. So I make a research of what was, how was, for instance, the landscape, the cultural landscape in South America, specifically in Tiwanaku and Tahuantinsuyo, the big empire of the Incas, before the Spaniards arrived in quest of the gold, you know. And so that's what I call then, that not was a discovery, that was a covering of traditional things, you know. We had the gold, yeah, but the gold represent art, you know. The keys play with golden butterflies. You see, it was in different values. Mm-hmm. So that's why the way to see the Eurocentrism way of thinking is say that, yeah, we have an alphabet, we will have to colonize you and teach how to speak Spanish and say this ABC. But they forgot that, or they didn't have in mind that the culture of South America had these notes, these quipus, to record their history and the background and the astronomy that was common old empire.
And I wanted to ask you about that. These quipus are they're strings, right?
That's
with,
right.
With so knots on them, and these knots, depending on the color and how far apart they are and so forth, tell you numbers and send you messages. And you can put a number of these strings on another string, right? And then you get, and then you have a message. It's like a message in knots.
That's correct, Mike, and you're very well informed. I'm happy for that. Yeah, it's not an alphabet, you know, if we consider an alphabet. It's a mnemonic thing that I will remember always as a Micah from the radio, for instance. And that's how they had a mnemonic idea, say we have 1,500 llamas or 20 kilos of corn, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's quite every node representing of the color, the position, as you said, and the size, and it represents something that it was really a record keeping.
So how do you use this to create art?
It is the image, you know. It's just the expression, is the figure of the notes and resembling a note, you know, that transplant me to another time. It's not a message in itself that is say, okay, this is a horse or this is a river, but yeah, there are some iconography that I represent also together with the notes to represent the rivers, mountains, animals that are implicit in the textiles, you know, because part of the textiles of the quipus are unified with the textiles that the clothes that the people used. So they had a nice way to communicate what was going on. So that's my part of my art, to resemble that note in an artistic way. Of course, I don't have the dictionary. Nobody had
right.
it yet.
And so if somebody from the Andes sees this quipu art that you make, and somebody from, say, you know, Indiana sees this quipu art that you make, do they have different reactions, do you think?
Probably not, because even in South America, so few people, you know about knots, you know,
because it's so old, because it's from the Incas, it's pre-Spanish,
before the Incas,
before
so it's 500 600 years ago that we have. But I guess the reaction is first of mystery. It's kind of, oh, I want to know something more about it, you know, and that's what to leads to some other discoverings.
Arceo, we have just about 30 seconds left, but I want to ask you, what's your hope for Edularte? What's going to happen to people who participate in this?
My hope is that I could see probably in a year or so kids that are playing instruments, people that are writing their chronics and their history of their own experience in the United States as immigrants, probably having a magazine or something that will somehow document things that people would do with their kids, just taking them to art classes or things like that. I'm really hoping to be able to partnership with different organizations in the community, colleges, universities, schools, art teachers, and all that will be having the same hope that the Latinos will have a space where they could express their voices and their hopes the same way that people here do.
Arcea Zapata de Aston is the founder and president of Educa, and Jorge Mendoza, a visiting painter from Bolivia via Miami. Thank you so much both for being here.
Yeah, and thank you for Educa and Wesleyan College to invite me and your station to put us on the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, this is the time on the show where you hear a weird noise, and that tells you that it's time for a weekly segment we call Tech Talk, where our associate producer and engineer Tony Voss brings us the latest news and tips from the technology world. And today's segment looks at some strange moves by Netflix, Tony.
That's right, Mike. My conversation with our technology expert, Justin Williams, this week was spurred on by the news that Netflix was once again annoying their subscribers, and the last time they did that was not that long ago. Justin tried to explain the situation to me by jumping back in time to that previous misstep.
We talked about this on either Tech Talk or DLC a couple of weeks ago, where Netflix came out and said that they were going to change their pricing structure once more, and they were basically going to double the price for people that use both Netflix streaming and Netflix's traditional DVD service, because they said that people love this instant stuff so much, having it just come straight to your Apple TV or your iPad or even your television or DVD player, that they didn't want to have to pay for DVDs as well. But if you're someone who uses both services like me, it was a pretty hefty price increase. In some cases, it was up to 50% price increase, which is insane. That's a lot to stomach. And Netflix wasn't the greatest in terms of like handling the fallout of this. They basically said, yeah, we know we're going to lose some subscribers, but it's okay. We don't care really. Goodbye. Have a nice life. Well, they actually lost 1 million subscribers. 1 million. That's a lot. Even if you think you're losing subscribers, when you see that you've lost 1 million of them, you start to wonder, well, maybe this wasn't the greatest idea. So Sunday night, Reed Hastings, who's the CEO of Netflix, penned a blog post on their site saying, yeah, we've kind of determined that people like this DVD stuff, so this is kind of our apology and how we're going to fix it. This is an interesting apology. Brace yourselves. They decided that they're going to spin off the DVD service outside of Netflix to a new company called Quixtar. And that service will be entirely based around traditional DVDs in your mailbox. And Netflix, as it's known today, will just be for streaming content from the web to your TV, your Apple TV, your mobile devices, and all those sorts of things. So now, instead of managing one account, you're going to be managing two. I haven't figured out how this makes me feel better.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like any sort of apology at all. If anything, it's starting to make things more complicated.
Here's a couple of reasons why this is more complicated. Number one, I've got to go to two different websites now. I've got to go to Netflix and I've got to go to Quixtar. Number two, I've got to deal with two different charges on my credit card now. I'm going to have one from Netflix and one from Quixtar. Now, let's look at a practical example of this, though. Let's say that I want to watch an Edward James Almost movie. All right, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the Netflix site and see, all right, can I watch this on Netflix Instant? Because I like instant gratification. I want to watch it right this moment. Okay, it's not on there. So traditionally, I could just say, all right, it's not instant, but add it to my DVD queue and I'm done. Now I'm going to have to change to the Quixtar website, add it to my DVD list there. All right, so I add it there. So Quixtar now knows that I like this Edward James Almost movie and it's going to recommend me something from Lou Diamond Phillips. But the Netflix site itself, it doesn't know these ratings because they're now separate, which is really confusing that two different sites are going to have two different sets of rating systems. It seems like a lot more work. And this is painful to me as someone who's a giant fan of Netflix and has been for a while because I watch a ton of movies, but they're really making it hard for me to recommend their service.
Okay, so obviously the this is our apology to you thing, that's a little sketchy. So Justin, why would they actually want to do this?
They won't come out and directly say this, but my theory is that they're separating the Quixtar stuff out into a separate company because DVDs in the mail have plateaued in terms of growth. There are never going to be more people getting DVDs in their mailbox than there are today. And when you look 2 years from now, that number is going to keep dwindling. And when they do their earnings reports and things like that, they don't want to say, yeah, our DVD business is kind of falling off. Even though everyone knows it's going to, it doesn't really tell a great story for Netflix when half their business is going away because it's a dying media.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that they really get to protect the Netflix brand here at a time when it's really going to be very important for them to position themselves as a pioneer in streaming when things like Hulu and Amazon TV are really starting to make a stake for themselves in that media.
Right. Netflix is certainly not the only game in town when it comes to streaming, but I think they are one of the most ubiquitous. I think Amazon Video is probably the second most, but Netflix is starting to build out their instant streaming catalog as quickly as they can. It's nowhere near where it needs to be to completely replace the DVDs for me, and I suspect for a lot of other people who like to watch new release films as well, which is why the DVD service is still so popular. But if it was me running the company, I would have been a lot more forthcoming and just said, yeah, we messed up, we're sorry. We're going to keep the old school DVD stuff, but we're not going to change it to a different company. We're just going to call it Netflix Classic. And you can still go to the Netflix.com site. It's still going to be tied into everything. You're still going to have everything there, but it's going to be off at a separate part of the Netflix.com site instead of being integrated into the front page and full experience of Netflix itself. I think that would have been a better way to handle this, but what do I know? I just talk on the radio. And just like the movies, we
play out our last scene. And to hear past Tech Talk segments, head over to our website, WNIN.org. That's where you can also find our web-exclusive Tech Talk DLC. This week, there's some insider info from Justin about Windows 8. And if you have any questions or suggestions for future Tech Talk conversations, well, let us know about it on Facebook at facebook.com/WNIN trend or by sending us an @reply on Twitter to @WNIN trend. Thanks, Micah.
Thank you, Tony. You're with The Trend on WNIN. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and this weekend is the 29th annual Native American Days at Angel Mounds State Historic Site between Evansville and Newburgh. And the event brings to life the more than 500-year-old site, which sits on the Ohio River where Vandenberg and Warwick counties meet. And joining us now in the studio is Angel Mounds Site Director Mike Linderman. He's also the State Historic Site's Western Regional Manager. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
So this is the biggest annual event that you have at Angel Mounds, and it accounts for a big number of the visitors you get to the site every year.
Yeah, and a good year we'll have 10 to 15,000 people in 3 days at the site.
And what are they coming out to see and do?
I'm hiding under my desk those 3 days, so I'm not sure what they're seeing. We have demonstrators. You can come out and you can learn how to flint knap or, you know, make arrowheads. We have a dugout canoe in construction, so you can go over there and help dig out the charred part of the interior of it. For those who want to get dirty, we have wattle and daub construction where we've built the walls and you can come mud the walls and plaster them with mud.
This would be for a dwelling place.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And then, you know, it was a fortified town, so the whole wall that surrounded the village site was wattle and daub as well. And then we have, you know, Native American performers. We have dance troops from out west doing, you know, dances that you would find in the western United States. We don't have Mississippian dancers because we don't know what they were doing there at the site. So you kind of get a cross section. You get some of the prehistoric aspects and some contemporary aspects of Native American culture.
And what would you say is the purpose or the goal of this program, this Native American Days at Angel Mounds?
I would say the number one goal is to dispel stereotypes that you'll find about Native Americans. It's not the teepees and the buffalo, especially with Angel Site. It was a thriving community where they lived year-round. And, you know, we do get into arguments with people about the teepees and the buffalo, but never once was there a teepee or a buffalo roaming the village site at Angel.
Well, you said it was a walled town.
That's
a very different image.
It is. It is. I always joke it was the first gated community in Evansville. But, yeah, they were either keeping somebody out or somebody in. The wall was at least 1.5 miles long and 15 foot high, generally speaking, throughout its run around the property. And that's with a Mississippian culture, you'll find walls either around ceremonial complexes or around the entire site like we have at Angel Mounds.
Now, you mentioned that 10 or 15,000 people come out to Native American Days, but Angel Mounds is also the kind of place that everybody went to it in fourth grade, but maybe they haven't been back. Remind us what this place was. When did people live there and how many people lived there?
All right. It was a middle Mississippian site, which we believe was inhabited anywhere between the year 1000 and about 1400, 1450, somewhere in there. And its zenith, it probably had 1,000 people living on the property. And it was the last gasp of the mound building in North America. When you think of the classic mound builders, you'll think of the Hopewell culture, where they built them for burial purposes. Mississippians were building their mounds for status. The larger the mound you lived on top of, the more important you were. And technically, these are not mounds. These are truncated pyramids. They have four sloping sides and a flat top, which residents or temple structures were erected on. So they're, you know, here in the Midwest, we often think of burial mounds, and that's mm-hmm. not what we have going on at Angel Mounds.
So earlier cultures would have done that, but not these Mississippians.
No. And not to say you won't find burials in these mounds, but that was not what they were built for. Sometimes you were buried in the floor of your home, and if your home happened to be on top of the mound, that's where you ended up being buried.
Why would you live on a mound? Better view?
I always say that our mounds are the mansions of the site. They were for the elite. And so we have 11 mounds on the property. So we just guess that we had 11 elite families living there on the property at one time. So the bulk of the community lived out in the flat areas around the mounds.
Now, you mentioned that the Native American days, you have you know, modern tribes mm-hmm. being represented. I guess, and you said you didn't know what the Mississippians would have been doing. Mm-hmm. We don't know how they were living exactly or how they were dancing or what mm-hmm. music they were playing. Is there any connection between the Mississippians and any modern tribes?
The closest we can come, we believe, is the Choctaw in the lower Mississippi. When DeSoto arrived in North America and was coming up the Mississippi, he documented a lot of his interaction with the Choctaw and their village layout. And it was very similar to a stereotypical Mississippian site. So we're going out on a limb and saying that the Choctaw are probably your closest match to a descendants of these people.
And they're now primarily based in Oklahoma, I believe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do modern Native Americans, I mean, you have all these Native Americans who come in to present their arts and their crafts and so forth. Mm-hmm. How do they relate to this site?
You know, that's a good question. They're very mindful how we're caring for the site. I'll say that. If we were not taking care of the property, I'm sure we would be told. I guess you could say it's a touchstone for them to get in touch with, you know, where they all came from.
The same way someone in Europe might relate to a castle or,
exactly.
or some
exactly.
old site that's a kind of cultural cornerstone
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you hosted the annual Mississippian Conference there this summer.
Yes.
And this is normally held at Cahokia Mounds in Illinois, but it was at Angel Mounds this summer. Set the scene for this conference. What happens there?
I think I've mentioned before, it's like the scene in The Godfather where all the families come together. All the major Mississippian site players are all in one room together for this annual meeting. It's a lot of archaeologists that come in and they, you know, they're bouncing their ideas off of the research that they've conducted throughout the previous year, new theories they have on Mississippian lifeways and what have you.
And did any new theories surface this year?
Nothing earth-shattering. Yeah, they were variations on previous themes or theories, I guess you could say.
But I gather there are some questions now about how the mounds were constructed, because they look like they would take a long time to build, right? Because they're really big.
Yeah, we've always had the theory at Angel that they were built basket load by basket load of soil, because in the late 50s, archaeologists did some test digs on one of the larger mounds, and in the profile of the trench wall, you could see what looked like islet shapes, and each one of those turned out to be one basket load that had been dumped and then left this imprint in the profile of that wall. But several years ago, IU did some coring on the property in one of those mounds, and in the base of it, we found out that they were using sod blocks as construction
which
material.
And does that speed up the process then?
Yeah, basically, they did not have access to stonework like you would have in Central and South America, but here, you know, they were cutting blocks of soil and sod. Yeah, and that would have sped up the process quite a bit.
And so that changes then the time frame in which these mounds were created.
Yeah, our large central mound, Mound A, that we refer to as that, for years was thought it was a 50-year project at least. And now we're based on this new material and some carbon dates on some of the grass that was still found in the mound. IU saying it was done in 10 years.
So pretty different from what you were thinking
before.
Yeah,
yeah.
Angel Mounds is trending right now on WNIN. We're talking with Mike Linderman from Angel Mounds, and we're about to be joined by Erica Ossel, who is a PhD student at Indiana University. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute. This is The Trend.
This is The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and online at WNIN.org. As a listener to public radio, you are the one who can make a difference through your first-time donation, or as a current contributor, make a big difference by becoming a sustaining member. Now we're going to ask you to make that difference during our upcoming fall membership drive starting on Saturday, October 15th. But if you prefer, why not make that difference right now? Go ahead and contribute at WNIN.org.
This is The Trend on WNIN. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Still ahead, our weekly feature, The Arts Notebook. Right now we're talking local archaeology with Mike Linderman from Angel Mounds. And let's bring another voice into the conversation. Erica Ossel is a PhD student in cultural anthropology at Indiana University in Bloomington. She was one of the instructors for this summer's field school at Angel Mounds. And she's with us by phone from the Glenn Black Archaeology Lab at IU. Hi, Erica. And Erica, describe what's the scene, you know, at the archaeology lab. What does it look like to be in this famous archaeology lab?
Well, actually, it's very exciting because we have a lot of work going on here. A lot of it surrounding Angel Mounds, and we're getting to know the site a lot better than before with new techniques, as Mike mentioned earlier, with new dating methods. It's really exciting to be part of this lab.
And you were an instructor this past summer at the annual summer school, the annual summer field school that IU has at Angel Mounds. And what was this summer's dig? What were you looking for? What were you doing?
Well, this summer, actually, we were just we were building off of previous excavations that occurred in the 1939 through 1942 by Glenn Black. So we were building off of that. What we were able to do is look at previous excavations, and then also look at a new material.
And Mike,
we kind of got to.
Go ahead.
Oh, we kind of got to look at the archaeology of archaeology by seeing how Glenn Black excavated.
Right. So Mike, the Works Progress Administration put people to work doing archaeology at Angel Mounds. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so, what were they looking for then? How was what they're digging for then different from how we dig for things now?
I think things are a lot more focused. You know, in those days, Glenn Black was looking at surface finds to look for where he was going to be digging. And, you know, the amount of information that IU can take out of the ground today is far more than what Glenn Black could do, just because of scientific advancements. They're pulling pollen out of the soil. They're pulling all kinds of seeds, things that Glenn Black would have, you know, pushed through a screen and never have seen the entire time they were doing the digs there.
So things he wouldn't even maybe have noticed, and things that were not valuable then, Erica, are now valuable.
Exactly, yeah. We definitely, one of the biggest differences is that we screen all of our material through very fine mesh. So we're pulling out a lot of the smaller things, such as beads, for example. So we have a lot more information to build off of.
When you're doing a dig, Erica, I assume you're not out there with a giant shovel or a pickaxe or something. What does a dig site look like?
Well, we actually do skim off some of the top material just because with a shovel, because it's more of a, it's been disturbed by farming, agriculture. So, but after we get that general layer off, we go in with our trowels and we take it down layer by layer, usually about 1 centimeter at a time. We try to follow what we see.
And how big of an area are you covering?
This year what we do is we dig in 1 by 1 square meter units. So we'll have some of those right next to each other, or you can just have one off by itself. But this summer we opened up 9 of those.
So you're working on a one meter by one meter, so about a 3 foot by 3 foot area going down 1 centimeter at a time. How long does it take to do one of those layers?
Well, it took us 6 weeks this summer to do 9 of those. So although we do go down 1 centimeter at a time, the more experienced you are, the more quickly you can go through that. So it goes quicker than it sounds.
You know, when you talk about looking for pollen and, you know, this very painstaking, careful approach that you have, it's pretty different than maybe popular images of archaeology that we have. How do people react, Erica, when you tell them that, that you're going to be an archaeologist? And that's what you, you know, you're getting a PhD in physical anthropology.
Well, I think they're surprised that it's not really like Indiana Jones, and it's a little more painstaking than they originally thought. But once you can explain what you can pull out of the ground and that information you can build up, hopefully people are interested.
And is this purely an academic pursuit, or is, are archaeologists used in other things as well?
It's not necessarily purely academic. I mean, we can be called out to, for example, sometimes rivers will erode and stuff will come out of the ground, so we can, those are called archaeological emergencies, so we can go out and do other kinds of work. But a lot of the information that we get comes from field schools and also teaching students how to dig.
Mike, we have a question from a listener that a listener submitted on Facebook before the show. Do you ever dig in the mounds themselves?
I don't think a mound has been touched since the 1940s.
Why?
Glenn Black's theory was these were, you know, focal points in the community. They were social centers. And what would you learn about the common everyday lifestyles of these people by focusing on that? I always compare it to, you know, 1,000 years from today, if they were to dig the Vandenberg County Courthouse spot, what are they going to learn about the people who lived in Evansville? You're not going to learn anything, really. And Black, he excavated the Temple Mound in the early 40s because it was... I'm not sure why he focused on that one, but after that, he didn't touch another mound. He did some tests up on top of our large mound to distinguish between some construction periods on it. But, yeah, that's never been one of our big things at the site.
Erica, also, if digging the courthouse, metaphorically speaking, isn't going to tell you much about the people who lived there, what are the things that tell you about who lived there?
Well, a lot of information comes from the faunal remains that we pull out of the ground. So, for example, what were everyday people eating? And then also a lot of focus is on pottery, for example, and that can tell you a lot about cultural trends and influences from surrounding regions.
And we have another listener comment that was submitted in advance of the show. This is from someone who worked in an archaeology lab, and she remembers the volume of material that is in an archaeological lab. What happens with all the all this stuff after the dig?
Well, it gets curated here at the GBL, and after that, we hopefully find some interested student to come do some research on it, and so we keep that all here.
Mike, archaeology, I assume, can happen in a lot of places, but not everywhere has something quite as big and significant as Angel Mounds. But is archaeology something that's in more places than we might imagine?
Yeah, we're always amazed. You know, we get people all the time coming out to say, well, I found this in my own backyard. And you try to, you know, mirror their enthusiasm, but there's stuff everywhere. It's unbelievable what we're all sitting on top of. And, yeah, Angel Mounds is, like you said, a nice focal point. It's flashy with the big mounds and all that. But just about anywhere you go, you're going to stumble upon archaeology.
What do you wish more people knew about archaeology?
I guess, you know, like Erica said, dispel the Indiana Jones myth that, you know, it is a painstaking process. And a lot of time and blood, sweat, and tears goes into that, literally, out at Angel Site, I know. So, yeah, it's, and, you know, I always tell people, it is a destructive science, and that's why, you know, there's a lot of painstaking work put into it, because once you've excavated the site, it's gone forever. And so there's a lot of responsibility put on these people's heads while they're doing the work out there.
Erica, we had another listener comment that when she thinks of archaeology, she thinks of Angel Mounds and the work that she saw there and all the painstaking note-taking. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things I don't think most realize is that there's a tremendous amount of paperwork involved with field schools, and that's for basically reference material for future researchers, because throughout time, methodologies surrounding archaeology has changed. So if you can go back and understand what they were thinking when they were digging it, it helps a lot, actually.
And that's the archaeology of archaeology that you mentioned, Mike.
Yeah. Exactly. Erica
mentioned. Yeah. Well, it's Native American Days this weekend, all weekend long at Angel Mound State Historic Site. A chance for guided tours also at the site, which I guess you normally don't do, Mike.
That's correct. Even I'm giving tours.
All right. Well, that's Mike Linderman from Angel Mounds. He's the site director there. We've also been speaking with Erica Ossel. She's a PhD student in cultural anthropology. She joined us from Indiana University in Bloomington. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. Don't forget, there's lots of information about The Trend at our website, wnin.org, including a chance to check out our Tech Talk DLC, and also an opportunity for you to hear this program again and other past Trend programs, all at our website, wnin.org.
This is The Trend on WNIN. I'm Micah Schweitzer. It's time for another weekly segment, The Arts Notebook, where we take a look at events happening this weekend. And today, The Courier's Leah Ward is in for Roger McBain. She edits the Diversions section of The Courier and Press. Hi, Leah. Welcome.
Hi.
And it's another one of those weekends when there's just a lot happening, including the annual Fiddler Fest in Newburgh. And I have to admit, when I moved here, I used to think that that was something involving violins, but I guess I was wrong.
No, Fiddlers refers to catfish. But there's also going to be country bluegrass music, too.
Okay, so there might be some violins with the catfish.
Yeah, maybe.
And where does this event take place?
It takes place at the Old Lock and Dam in Newburgh, and the Fiddler dinners will be served today from 5 to 8. Saturday from 11 to 8 and Sunday from 11 to 5. And there also will be a beer garden, craft and food vendors, and children's activities.
Okay, that's the annual Fiddler Fest in Newburgh. Now there's another annual festival, this one taking place in Evansville, called Funk in the City. It's an arts festival.
Yeah, that takes place at Haney's Corner in the Arts District at 2nd and Adams Avenue.
And I know that festival features a lot of good food and music, but of course the centerpiece is art.
Right. There'll be more than 100, mostly regional artists, and the admission is 5 for adults. Kids are free, and a portion of the proceeds will go to the Boys and Girls Club of Evansville for a 9-week arts education program.
Okay, and I know some of the things happening this weekend are multi-day events, but this is a one-day event.
Right. And right. It's from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday.
Okay. Also on Saturday, this is also an annual event happening at the Evansville Museum.
Yes, it's the Evansville Museum Contemporary's Brouhaha, and it will be from 6 to 10 Saturday, and it will feature micro, specialty, homemade, and imported beers, and there also will be food and entertainment.
To help soak up the beer.
Yeah.
Which, given the nature of the event, it's limited to 21 and older, right?
Right. And tickets are 25 in advance and 30 at the door.
Okay. What about a free event happening this weekend?
Well, the LA-based group, the Watson Twins, will perform an outdoor show at 6:30 tonight at UE, and that will be next to the Ridgeway Center.
Okay, and they have a University of Evansville connection, the Watson Twins.
Yes, their father coached UE basketball in the 70s, and they're also UE graduates.
All right, so coming back for a free performance this evening at the University of Evansville. And one more event that we want to highlight, and this one features arts and crafts.
Yeah, it's the Vandenberg County Extension Homemakers Fine Arts and Crafts Show. At the 4-H Center, and it will be Saturday and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and admission is $2, and kids under 10 are free.
Okay. Now, there's more on these and lots of other events happening around the region this weekend online at courierpress.com. Leah Ward edits the diversions page. And Leah, do you have tips for groups or people who want to submit items for inclusion on the diversions page?
Yes, the best way to get events to me is by email. And my email is wardl@courierpress.com. Or they can fax the information to me at 422-8196.
And what are the kinds of information you're looking for?
Just basic information. They just need to, you know, any event that just basically I just need the date, time, place, and a little bit about the event.
Because you're not writing articles based on them. You're doing a calendar, all about summary, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, Leah Ward edits the diversions section of the Courier and Press. She's here filling in for Roger McBain on the Arts Notebook. And thanks so much for your time, Leah.
You're welcome.
We'd like to hear your reactions to this week's show, and we'll read from those comments next week. And next time on The Trend, we're talking about the role of arts in education. How do subjective things like music and art fit into a world of standardized tests? Also, one community's creative, environmentally friendly solution to its combined sewer overflow problem. Those are going to be coming up next week on The Trend, and you can submit questions and comments in advance of the show. Post on our Facebook page, that's at facebook.com/WNINTrend, or you can connect with us on Twitter at WNINTrend. You can stream and download a podcast of today's show at WNIN.org and CourierPress.com, and this is brand new. You'll also find us on iTunes, as well as in the NPR podcast directory at npr.org. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Our associate producer and engineer is Tony Voss. Ella Johnson Watson is our producer at the Courier and Press. Our intern is Carolina Tote, and this show's theme music was composed by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.